This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The great American superhero emerged from the imaginations of young, mostly Jewish misfits three quarters of a century ago. Naive, lonely, shy nerds, we'd call them today. They often worked for ruthless backstabbers, publishers, yes, but pornographers and bullies, too. And between them, they invented a new way to tell stories and a new way to sell them. Superman may have started as a comic book, but spread to radio, television, the movies, action figures, you name it. In the course of an effort to separate small boys from their dimes, they invented franchise marketing, a new fiction genre, and, along the way, geek culture. Later on in the program, we're going to explain why Wired magazine wants you to steal their CD digitally, but first to an older technology, the spectacular, sad, and frequently tawdry history of the comic book industry. If you've worked in comic books, or if you've read and reread your dog-eared copies of Superman or Archie, we want to hear from you. What have you always wanted to know about the true history of how these things came to be? We might be able to even confirm or deny some of the myths and stories you may have heard. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Gerard Jones chronicles the tale, the real-life story of Cavalier and Clay, if you will, in his new book, Men of Tomorrow, Geeks, Gangsters, and the Birth of the Comic Book. And he's with us from the Palatine Recording Studios in Portland, Oregon. And it's good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Can first of all, tell us why all of this is important. Comic books starting, what, in early 1930s?
Well, I've always liked books that are about one thing, but that open up windows to something else. And what I found in tracking the history of the superhero and the comic book was it was part of a lost American history. There's a whole story of these marginalized cultural forms and cheap magazines, girly magazines that loop and twist around prohibition, racketeering, life in the streets, life on the Lower East Side. And there's a sense of America really kind of inventing itself, because these were street hustlers who became cheesy magazine publishers, who built something that eventually became part of the Time Warner industry, the whole publicly owned international entertainment industry.
And there are some interesting mixtures in this primordial soup that gave birth to the comic books, including feminism, selling condoms by direct mail, and of course, gangsters.
One of the key guys I look at is Harry Donenfeld, who was the son of a Romanian Jewish immigrant who was a hustler on the Lower East Side, became a garment salesman, just sort of did anything he could to survive. Picked a few pockets, did a few swindles, but ended up as a printing salesman in the 20s, and from there became a distributor of cheap magazines. And among his many clients were Margaret Sanger, who he apparently printed at least the covers for the Birth Control Journal, Birth Control, and the Woman Rebel. And in his distribution seems to have been involved in also one of Sanger's industries, which was selling condoms and diaphragms and douche kits by mail and through the drug stores and the cigar stores of America. And had his hand, he was also involved with the crooked Tammany Hall Democratic machine. And he ran some liquor, and he was involved with Frank Costello and Lucky Luciano and those guys, using his Canadian paper buying contacts to bring whiskey in from Canada as well. So these guys who knew how to make connections and who were in the middle of that alternative culture of the 20s, both the licit and the illicit, made the most astonishing connections and created an odd sort of a counterculture of their own, chasing a quick buck, but by using what was out there, what was available to an immigrant kid.
And their story then coincides with the story of these geeks, Jerry Siegel, Joe Shuster, I guess, are the best-known examples, the two teenagers who created Superman.
Yeah, it was a strange, you know, they came from sort of different ends of the same world. Those guys were also the children of East European Jewish immigrants, but they were born about 15, 20 years later than the Harry Donenfelds and the guys like him. Mm-hmm. And their dads had moved up a little bit. So they lived in this in Glenville, which was a neighborhood of Cleveland. It was a middle class neighborhood. And Jerry Siegel had the luxury, he was the baby in a family of six, and he had the luxury of being able to go up into the attic bedroom in his mother's house and type out these fantastical science fiction stories. And he really was a kind of a prototypical geek. My one big anachronism in the book is I use this word geek to describe some, you know, back then a geek was somebody in a carnival who bit chickens' heads off.
But right.
it's become a cultural type now, and I kind of track the whole geek culture as it evolved out of 20s science fiction fandom. And Jerry Siegel was at the forefront of that. And he and his buddy Joe Shuster, who was a bodybuilder, he was into all these, you know, the sort of the Charles Atlas genre of physical culture and fitness and health and all these magazines. They put together the crazy, geeky science fiction stuff with this love of the male body, men in tights, men posing, men strutting, sticking their chests out. And Superman came, this kind of miraculous alchemical process of two scrawny little unpopular guys looking for that alternative self.
And as you note, that these guys are, in a way, unexamined. There's a great line in your book. You say, people have certainly looked at Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, but it's all about bibliography and none about biography.
I'm glad you liked that line. That was one of those lines. I just sat there and stared at it for about 10 minutes, and I said, damn, that's a good one. I like that one. What's true, because most of the history of comics has been done by fans. They're people who grew up reading superheroes, and they kind of want to keep that thrill of reading superheroes going. And there's some, you know, very smart people out there doing these things. But the focus has always been to kind of make the superheroes more real, to get more under the skin of the superheroes. So they want to look at, did Superman come from Flash Gordon? Did he come from Tarzan? You know, what combination of influences did he come from? But they didn't go and talk to the surviving relatives and say, who was Jerry Siegel? Who was this kid? And I went to Cleveland, and I started talking to old guys who were related to him or knew the family and who were not in that science fiction-y culture. His cousin Irv Fine, who was in real estate development, his cousin Jerry Fine, who worked for the post office. You know, these are like regular guys, but who knew Jerry when he was the young nerd. And then the stories start to come out, and this is where I discovered the fact that Jerry Siegel's father had been shot to death in an armed robbery when he was a teenager. And a couple of years later, he creates this hero who is bulletproof. You look at the early Superman, and he couldn't fly. He didn't have X-ray vision. But what he was, very distinctly, was invulnerable. He could be shot, he could be stabbed, and he would just grin. And by going into the biography, I think I really began to get a much better sense of what the superhero is for, culturally and psychologically.
If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We're speaking with Gerard Jones. His book is Men of Tomorrow, Geeks, Gangsters, and the Birth of the Comic Book. And let's talk with Dave, who's calling from Rochester, New York.
Yeah, hi, Neil. Hi, Gerard. Nice to talk to you both. I wanted to ask Gerard if he remembers a comic book maybe back from the 50s called Black Hawk. It was kind of like about a team of superheroes flew in jet planes.
Yep.
That one?
Yeah, it actually started. It was an interesting thing. It's one of the things you find in comics. It was created right before the U.S. entered World War II,
okay,
after the Nazis had started to sweep through Europe.
Yeah.
And it was created by several guys were involved. Will Eisner was the best known guy involved.
Okay.
But he had a studio of mostly the sons of immigrants, artists in New York, who were very much anti-Nazi, pro-intervention, who wanted to see the U.S. get in and fight fascism, but the U.S. wasn't doing it yet. And like there were several comics at the time that found ways to do these anti-Nazi messages and start to stir up. And it wasn't as if this was coordinated with the government. This was just coming out of these, you know, these 20-year-old guys of Jewish or Polish or Hungarian background. And that's what Black Hawk was. It was about a bunch of non-Americans, but a bunch of European allied fighters fighting the Nazis. And then they found a way to keep it.
It was one of those United Nations platoons. There was one a French guy and an English guy and various people.
The leader was Polish, too, which was interesting.
Yeah.
He might be the only early prominent Polish comic book hero.
Dave, thank you.
Black Hawk, too. You there still?
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. I thought you were done.
There's one other thing about Black Hawk. If my memory serves me right, later in the comic book series, they flew in jet planes. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
In the 50s.
Yeah, they updated. They fought aliens and monsters, and, you know, they tried to keep it alive. But it really, in its heart, it was kind of a left-leaning anti-Nazi fantasy of being able to go over there and fight that particular supervillain. Mm-hmm.
Dave, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
So long. Let's talk now with Mark. Mark is calling from Cleveland.
Home of Superman.
Home of Superman.
Yeah, Mr. Joel, before I ask my question, I just want to tell you how much I enjoyed Batman Jazz, as well as your previous books, Honey, I'm Home, and Killing Monsters.
Know my stuff.
Your cousin Mark from Cleveland, yeah.
No, my lost, forgotten cousin Mark from Cleveland. Thank you, that's great. I'm glad somebody's been reading my stuff over the years.
Yeah, anyway, my question is, you know, of course it's ironic that the gangsters were involved in the distribution of comic books when so often the villains portrayed in the comic books were gangsters. Do you have any... ideas as to what the gangsters saw this, and especially about their own depiction in these books?
Well, yeah, some of them apparently really liked these things. There were a couple of actually members of Murder Incorporated who were big comic book fans. There was a guy named Dookie Muffatori who loved Superman more than anything. He just sit around reading Superman all the time. It's the same way I think that, you know, Al Capone loved Little Caesar, and the movie studios that were making the gangster movies were also, you know, in bed with Willie Bioff and the whole mob-driven electricians union scandal. I think there was a desire to see the world in these big black and white terms of good guy, bad guy, and you could kind of identify with the good guy and the bad guy. And even a thug can well, maybe particularly a thug can get into that image of what's, you know, of simple victory and defeat and simple good and evil. Even if the guy who looks like him is on the bad side, you know, there's that glamour to being the gangster who gets brought down by the good guys. So I think that I don't think they would have seen any particular conflict. In fact, they probably enjoyed the portrayals of themselves.
Maybe they were thinking, see, no ordinary cop can take me down. It took Superman.
Yeah, precisely. You know, because the gangsters in comics were pretty impressive. They didn't, you know, they didn't go to jail for income tax evasion. You know, they had great fights with these guys in tights.
Mark, thank you.
You're welcome.
Here's an email question from Ashton Spann. I'm wondering why you and your guest find it necessary to describe some of the people you've talked about so far as Jewish. What does their being Jewish have to do with the subject?
That's a good one. The fact is the industry was about 90% Jewish early on. The distribution was overwhelmingly the children of Jewish immigrants. Almost all East European, almost all Russian, Romanian, Polish, not so much the more established German and Austrian Jewish populations, but the guys who were coming over in the 1880s and 1890s, mostly working in the garment trade, and then their kids were looking for other ways to make a living. And you look at, there was an entire New York community of people who were up from the Lower East Side who were getting into the cheap magazine business. And then, you know, that makes sense at a certain basic economic logic. This was a field open to them. There were a lot of Jewish printers in New York at the time. But interestingly, too, when you look at the cartoonists, the young guys doing this stuff on their own, even there, it's primarily Jewish. Superman, Batman, the Spirit, these were mostly the creations of young Jewish men, mostly lower middle class. Captain America was another one. And I think it was an expression of kids who were on the outside, who were marginalized, who were trying to move into the American mainstream and actually succeeding in doing so, and who were kind of taking that American popular culture as their own and putting their own fantasies of potency and power and being able to put on another identity on the page. Now, it wasn't all Jewish. There were Irish, there were Hungarians, there were Polish, and there was even a smattering of WASPs, although not so many. It was mostly a kind of a, you know, it was a blue-collar urban population that created the comics. But the big ones, virtually all the big characters, were created by young Jewish men.
We're talking about the birth and evolution of the comic book industry, the hucksters, the geeks who gave the world Superman, and we're taking your calls, 800-989-8255. The email address, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation, NPR News.
No, bring back Captain Marvel, bring back my ideal. He had superpowers that made the villain scram. I was thrilled for hours each time he said Shazam.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the early days and the evolution of the comic book industry, a story of full of larger-than-life characters and over-the-top plot twists as the pulpy pages that gave it life. Our guest is Gerard Jones, who chronicles this era in his new book, Men of Tomorrow. Of course, you're invited to join us. Are there apocryphal tales of comic history you've always wondered about, or memories of your own run-ins with the industry? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN at NPR.org. And let's get another caller on the line. Arturo is with us from Lawrence, Kansas.
Yes, thanks for having me. I was going to ask your guest a question about the cartoonist Jack Kirby and the influence that his style had on comics in the last 20 and 30 years, but also how, you know, he's not really well known and outside just the comic book circle, but yet his writer Stan Lee is very, very well known, especially with all the Marvel movies coming out with his signature on them.
Yeah, Jack Kirby, obviously of a later generation than the people we've been talking about before. But Gerard, go ahead.
Yeah, well, actually, Jack had a couple of moments of huge impact. He was the co-creator, the visual creator of Captain America back in 1941, which had a huge impact in the way that action was drawn. Kind of took it from that more fairy tale-ish Superman quality down to the really gritty, you know, the flying fists and the bodies whipping through space and all that. And then again, in the 60s, he was involved in the creation, well, he's the primary creator, I think, really, of the X-Men and the Hulk and Fantastic Four. So the whole Marvel Comics revolution owes a lot to Jack. One of the things about comics that has made the pulling together of the story so challenging and so much fun is that so many of these guys were tall tale tellers. They were inventors of their own myths. And again, these were poor kids of immigrants, trying to establish themselves as Americans and men of tomorrow. They were all focused on their futures, their potentials, and they would go around and rewrite history every time they opened their mouths. And Jack was kind of a quiet guy. He was a small kid. He was very poor, Lower East Side. Got a little defensive and a little bit sullen. Was not a great projector of his own legend. And his partner in the Marvel stuff, Stan Lee, is a people person. I mean, I love Stan, and it's difficult to kind of get into all this stuff without feeling like I'm stepping on anybody's feelings. But he was a tremendous self-promoter, and Stan became almost by accident the figurehead of Marvel Comics, and he was perfect for that, this kind of 60s pussycat. And Jack just got kind of left behind. Stan institutionalized himself as Marvel's symbol, and you find this throughout. I also talk about how Bob Kane, the creator of Batman, pushed away his collaborators and buried them and hid their credits. And Stan did a much better job of allowing other people to share the credit. But you get a bunch of guys out there trying to mythologize themselves, and the ones who are better at it, like Stan, get known, and the ones who weren't so good at it, like Jack, are really only known for the people who bother to read the credits.
Arturo, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Let's talk now with Devin. Devin's calling from Oakland, California.
Hi, Neil. Hi, Jerry.
Hey, Devin.
I wanted to bring up the topic of today's comic book reading demographic and kind of ask what you think about, we could call it the evolution of the nerd, maybe. Obviously, there's a complicated marketing issue behind that, but sociologically, what does it mean to you that we now have primarily, really almost exclusively, adult readers?
Yeah, adolescent and adult, and much more female than they were for a while. Although it's interesting, you go back into the 40s, you discover it was pretty much split. I mean, it was boys and girls both. And even in the late 40s, when you start to get the adult readers with the romance and the horror comics, it was men and women both. It's really kind of only in the 60s that the model of the comic book reader has to be an 11-year-old boy happened. I think, well, apart from all the marketing issues, I think one thing that's happened that I talk about a little bit at the end of the book is how geek culture, what was once the culture of either the little kid or the outcast, has become almost the norm. I mean, as we have moved into a much more evolved consumer culture, and as these sort of fetishistic totems of emotion and personal private fantasies become just part of what's all around us, and as we all go into this mythologizing, self-inventing process, what used to be oddball kid stuff is now there. It's everywhere. It's in the video games, the movies, and even the movies that are not about superheroes are largely tinged by this kind of superhero fantasy. And So I think it's more acceptable and almost even culturally required to have some participation in this crazy fantasy, and that's made the comic book, whatever its subject, kind of relevant to who we are now.
Devin, are you a fan?
I'm a fan of Jerry's, and I work in the industry. Yes,
Devin's.
I write comic books.
Very good superhero writer.
Which one do you write?
Right now, I'm writing Nightwing, who's the grown-up Robin. And I've worked in the past on Batman and X-Men, and it has been interesting to watch the people who write comics changing along with the people who've been reading them.
Can you make a living doing this?
That's what I'm doing right now.
Okay.
The skin of my teeth, but yes.
Well, Gerard, you used to write comic books yourself.
I did, actually. I was writing comics when Devin was breaking in. I was one of the people, I think, who sat down and talked to her about how do you make this work. I was writing in the late 80s and early 90s. I wrote Green Lantern, Justice League, a little bit of Batman, a little bit of everybody.
Devin, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you so much, Neil.
Appreciate it.
It was interesting because when Devin was starting to come up at the end of the 80s, it was still pretty unusual for a cute 24-year-old female writer to be trying to get in. And now I think they're kind of used to that. I mean, I think it's really become a bi-gendered field. But she got a lot of attention from lonely male editors, I think, in the beginning.
Well, I don't know about cute, but joining us now is another comic books writer. This is Chris Claremont, who's been on both sides of the street. That means both editorial and as a writer, mostly with Marvel. He's best known for the Uncanny X-Men, which he wrote for ever, I think, Chris. Isn't that right?
Pretty much, yeah.
I'm interested. The stories about the people who created the industry, and not just the Siegel and Schusters, but the Harry Donenfelds, are their stories still told in the comic book industry today?
Well, I think that not so much as we would like. There's always been a certain reluctance to hold on to institutional memory in comics. I think that's why I think books like Gerard's are valuable. I mean, in Marvel, the one, I guess, significant advantage is that Stan Lee was such a presence for so long. I mean, I feel in a weird situation because when I started working for Marvel as a gopher, Stan was still actively editor-in-chief back in the end of the 60s. So it's kind of like, I don't know, apprenticing for D.W. Griffith and finding yourself still, for better or worse, actively directing today. And it's fascinating from that perspective to see how the industry has changed in ways that are both good and bad. So I would like to make one slight adjustment. I've worked with Devin as well, but there were a whole host of women writers who came in the late 70s and early 80s, Louise Simonson, Joe Duffy, Anne Nesenti, that I think laid the foundation for them as the writers of the 60s, Roy Thomas, Gary Friedrich, and the like, laid them for me and Len Wein and others of my generation.
I think what was interesting, too, is that in the beginning, I think most of the guys who wrote the comics would have preferred to be in the newspaper comic strips or in the pulp magazines. And that was sort of the character of the field early on, was a lot of guys who wish they could have done something different. In the 60s, the people that Chris just mentioned, you suddenly have the entrance of these real fans, people who grew up on the material and loved the heroes and wanted, in a sense, to keep the heroes alive. And at a time when comics were not doing very well, and really almost by force of will and creative passion kept the field alive. Mm-hmm. And that's been a big shift. It's been a much more fan-driven and much more driven by personal emotional investment in the medium recently.
Well, I think also the irony of that was that as more and more of the creative writing community and more as importantly the editorial community came out of fandom, the stories tended to be much more about, sadly, the minutiae of the characters. They became more and more isolated for a time from the world around them.
Inside baseball, almost.
Yeah. And while they were very exciting for the converted, there wasn't a lot to speak to the people who were just wandering in and taking a look at them in a way, say, that when you look at Lynn Johnson's For Better or Worse, has remained an incredibly vital, engaging, and often emotionally powerful, but always relevant newspaper strip for the last couple of decades.
Mm-hmm. But when it really clicked, Chris wrote the X-Men during a crucial moment in comics development, and I think he played a huge role in bringing these characters to life in a way that they had not been before. And I think a lot of the what I'm calling the mainstreaming of geek culture actually came out of that, because you could be a sensitive adolescent, you could be an adult, and you could connect to these oddball characters in tights with superpowers. And that was a major shift, I think. That's partly why people, grown-ups are reading these things now.
Let's get a caller in on the conversation. Let's go to Kevin. Kevin's with us from Las Vegas, Nevada.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, when I was growing up through the 70s, I was a big comic book collector, and I'm kind of going back to what Devin was starting to talk about. I've noticed, I don't really collect anymore, but I've noticed that kids, and I have two young children of my own, kids don't collect comics. They're into, of course, Yu-Gi-Oh! Or Pokemon or whatever the latest trading card game is, or video games, and that's, of course, how they know superheroes. But there isn't a lot of kids that go to a comic book store anymore. In fact, it's very few comic book stores in existence. So I guess I want to ask you to talk a little more about kind of the changes or evolution of the market for comics, and the only people reading them today really are older kids or adults, or even there they get most of that from the internet or from games.
Although at the same time, these characters that came out of the comics, these superheroes that were once unique to comics, are everywhere in terms of movies and action figures. And I mean, these have just become sort of national symbols, sort of silly symbols of potency at this point. So it's like the content that the comics brought has divorced a bit from the comics themselves. And a lot of the best and most popular comics out there now are things like, Chris Ware or Art Spiegelman or Dan Klaus's very adult-oriented comics that have no superheroes in sight. So that's the medium survives by the passion of those people who are really invested in it. But what it gave to the larger culture has actually turned out to work maybe better in other ways of storytelling, and continue to be obviously very vital parts of the American fantasy life. I think when the new Superman and Batman movies come out, I'm sure they'll strike chords as they always have.
Chris, do comic books as comic books still make money today, or do they make them from these other spin-offs and movies and various other things?
I think it's all of the above. I think Marvel, the fundamental change in Marvel over the last 15 years, you could come to Marvel in 1988, and what you would see is an incredibly successful publishing company that made a nice living for all of its people, but was not very effective in terms of licensing. Now you have this huge licensing juggernaut of which publishing is a small but still profitable aspect of it. And I think that the publishing is, in a sense, the seed corn from which you keep generating new concepts and new, again, from Marvel's point of view, exploitable material that they can try and market then as movies or TV or games or what have you, the next generation of X-Men plus five, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But just to go back one step, I admittedly I'm biased. Admittedly, this is anecdotal, but I have a pair of 7-year-olds and they love comics. That's actually the one guaranteed way to keep them occupied in a road trip, or at a restaurant or anywhere. You just give them like four or five comics, and they're gone for an hour. And they're making the connection between the words and the images. They're spinning the stories off into adventures of their own. My frustration is that as a parent, there aren't a lot of books available to give them. And it's unfortunately we have this vast middle ground which is aimed at the teenage young adult male market there's the incredibly sophisticated stuff that Art and Dan Klaus are doing. And there's like five or six books at the lower end, in mostly from DC. Now Marvel is struggling with Marvel Age. There's still, thankfully, Archie and Jughead that are available for young readers, for 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds, to get them interested in the medium and sort of hooked on it before they're grabbed by Yu-Gi-Oh! And electronic entertainment.
Kevin, thanks very much for the call.
One other quick comment.
I have to say that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Kevin, go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Just to follow up what Chris said there, I mean, I'm very happy to hear his kids are reading comics. You know, out here in Las Vegas, if I saw a kid reading a comic, I'd probably fall off my chair. But something else along with Chris said there about it's very difficult to find comics for young kids. You know, comics have become very complex, both in the way they draw the comic and, of course, the storyline itself, the violence factor, the sex factor, et cetera, is so magnified today. You know, when I was reading comics in through the 70s, and, of course, I collected older comics, I was lucky enough to read a lot of Golden Age and a lot of the stuff Chris wrote. You know, these were great stories. They were fascinating. I mean, they engaged you. They made you want to buy the next issue. And the artwork was fantastic. You know, Kirby and Starlin and Neil Adams and those guys. And just now it's so overdone, it seems. It's just they pushed the limit so much that, you know, Chris is right. You can't go to your local Barnes & Noble and buy a comic book and just hand it to your 7 or 8-year-old and say, read this, because it'd be almost like, you know, letting them watch an R-rated movie every time it pops up on TV. Hmm. So
a lot of kids now are reading the Japanese comics. My son, who's 11, is reading Ranma Half, which is a Japanese, you know, kind of funny adventure Japanese comic. I think that when you get a culture like Japan where comics are a little more mainstreamed, which is what they were to a greater extent here in the late 30s and 40s, there's a lot more available. Although comics, I have to say, have always had a tendency to move sort of toward the sordid, because it is a way, it's a way of putting images on paper that might be too difficult, scary, or expensive to do photographically, and it's a way that cartoonists can let their imaginations move, which often will take a sleazy edge. So from very early, comics have been running afoul of citizens groups and parent groups, and have always worked this line. I mean, from the beginning. I mean, even the early superhero material in 38, 39, 1940 already being jumped on by the National Organization for Reading Decency and people like that.
The whole sordid story is in Men of Tomorrow, Geeks, Gangsters, and the Birth of the Comic Book. Gerard Jones, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks a lot.
And also our thanks to Chris Claremont, a longtime comic writer, former editorial director of Marvel Comics. Chris, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Neil.
Chris reached Chris in Brooklyn, New York. When we come back from the break, from the Men of Tomorrow to the copyright law of tomorrow, we'll look at a new CD that encouraged listeners to trade, remix, and sample the tracks. Back after the break, I'm Neil Conan, and it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.